Professor John Horgan is the press ombudsman, a former journalist and politician. He's a retired professor of journalism at Dublin City University. Now, in the wake of the RTE libel settlement with Father Kevin Reynolds, he was asked by RTE to conduct a review of their journalistic guidelines and procedures. This report influenced the new RTE guidelines introduced last month and was finally published last Friday. John Horgan is with me now. John, thank you very much for coming in. Now, in your report, you make a point that a key concern in journalism practice today is a blurring of the line between fact and opinion. What do you mean by that?
The old-fashioned forms of journalism tended to separate news and comment rather more rigidly than they have been separated in recent times. Perhaps I'm just old-fashioned, but I find myself a little bit uneasy sometimes with what I would describe as news with attitude, to put it mildly, or to put it less mildly, attack journalism. Now, I'm all in favour of journalists having opinions and expressing them, and lively, combative, controversial journalism is really something that we would be very much poorer without. But if there's nothing else, it seems to me to give the impression of serving their audiences with pre-digested opinions about people and about issues. And I'm not sure that that's entirely the best thing. I'd prefer to see a slightly greater proportion of our newsprint and media generally devoted to giving people the kind of information that they need to make decisions for themselves. Part of it is related to, I'm sure, the extreme financial difficulty that the journalism and newspaper model is going through at the moment. This heightens competitive pressures. It means that if there is the possibility of selling more papers or getting more watchers and viewers by either frightening people or making them angry, that you're going to go there rather than standing back a bit and presenting information in a more dispassionate way. So I think that's a tendency. It doesn't have to be a fatal tendency, but I think it should be kept under reasonable control.
Do you think that was an element in what Anna Carraher identified as groupthink, or what she defined as groupthink in relation to the Reynolds proposition?
I'm not sure, insofar as the Catholic Church and the clergy of the Church have been under fire for so long, that this was hardly new that a television programme or a newspaper article or whatever would set out to attack the Church or part of it. The main problem is related to something that Anna Carraher called groupthink, but it's a little bit more complex than that. I think when you have teams of people working on stuff, and it's very important, particularly in investigative journalism, where the resources are so badly needed and where you need as many helping hands as you can, where you have groups of people and teams of people working on projects, it's terribly important that there should be a point, maybe just before the team is finally committed to the project, where everybody can sit down around a table and say, look, let's imagine ourselves in the situation 12 months from now where this was a total disaster. Imagine why it became a total disaster. And that gives members of the team the possibility to raise any and every criticism without feeling that they're being in any way disloyal to the thrust of the programme, to the general spirit of inquiry and investigation that animates the team and so on. Because it's the loyalty thing. It tends to cover a multitude when it should be perhaps examined a bit more closely sometimes.
But is that not what editorial guidance is there for? Is that not exactly a definition of the function of an editorial role? But surely in every news organisation, you've got an editorial layer or level that will say, well, hang on a second, let's subject this to some more objective consideration.
Most editorial systems do work like this most of the time. But as I said in my RTE report, there is absolutely no system that is proof against mistakes. Mistakes will happen, and sometimes they will be big ones, and you just pray that the ones that you make aren't going to be big ones with the kind of consequences that the Father Reynolds thing had for RTE. So I think you do have to prepare for that. One of the recommendations I made, which I think Anne Carraher took up slightly askew in her report, I suggested that if there was an investigative programme being made that had a big public interest justification. In other words, they were going to do things that were sailing on the line or even over the line and would have to be justified in terms of the public interest, that somebody senior in the team should maybe go to somebody else in the organization, person of stature, whose opinion they valued, invite them to have a look just at the public interest justification for what they were doing on an informal basis, not to veto it, not to say yay or nay. That person wouldn't have the deciding voice, but just to bounce it off somebody else. I think Anna took that recommendation up as meaning that there should be somebody officially appointed in RTE to have this function. I think that's going too far. I think that's over-institutionalising the idea. But I think it's the kind of thing that might happen informally in any case. And it's always useful in medicine, law, wherever, you get a second opinion.
Well, I see that one of the BBC rubric is, if in doubt, refer up. But the suggestion in a BBC report in a similar situation was that maybe sometimes this may be seen as a sign of weakness or uncertainty about your material. Is that a hindrance, you think?
The hidden danger in all reference up systems is that nobody wants to take responsibility for anything and that all the decisions will end up on the last table in the shop, you know. And you do need to inculcate responsibility and decision-making at every level.
Is that not a risk now, though, that that's what's going to happen?
I think history shows that when something like this happens in any organisation, there is an immediate chilling effect. I mean, it happened after the sacking of the authority in 1972, and it was probably happened after any big legal action, particularly in any newspaper or any media organisation, this chilling effect happens. I just hope that in the case of RTE, it won't be unduly pronounced or unduly lengthy, because RTE is one of the few organisations with the resources to put into investigative reporting. And that, coupled with its statutory requirements to be fair and so on, is a huge public protection that I would like to see not endangered in any serious way or for any great length of time.
In your report, John, you mentioned the fact that the public interest wasn't effectively defined anywhere within the existing RTE guidelines. Mm. Can you define that for us?
It's very difficult to define public interest. We have a definition of it in the Press Council Code of Practice, which is a pretty good one. Basically, it refers to something that the public are entitled to know to enable them to come to mature and considered decisions, and that the media organisation concerned has a legitimate interest in telling them. Now, that's very vague, and some people might say it's too imprecise. The new RTE guidelines are a bit more precise. They have sort of subheadings about serious crime and this, that and the other, which spell it out in a bit more detail. And as far as they go, I have no difficulty with those. In fact, I helped RTE to draft those definitions, but I think it was very important that there should be a definition of the public interest. One of the interesting things about the Press Council is that until the Press Council and my office was established, there was no definition of the public interest, and the people who decided about whether the public interest or not was a justifiable defence were the newspaper editors, and sometimes not even the editors, but the reporters. They have now transferred the power to make the decision about whether a particular piece of journalism was in the public interest or not away from themselves and to myself and the council. That's a huge transfer of power, and I don't think it's often recognised that that's what it is.
Investigative journalism is obviously a very expensive undertaking. As a consequence of what happened here, are we not piling layer upon layer of disincentive onto investigative journalism, which has brought about fantastic revelations that were required in our society? Is it not going to be more difficult?
It's a balancing act. And when I started to write my report, I was extremely conscious, and I think Anna Carraher was very conscious of this as well, of the need to avoid the over-bureaucratization of the journalism function. And in big organizations who want to play safe, the tendency is to bureaucratize, and I think that does have to be kept in check. I mean, when you think back on the early days of investigative journalism, you had people like I.F. Stone in America, like Joe McAntony here of the Sunday Independent. These were people who were solo operators. They didn't have teams. Fintan O'Toole for McGill. They vanished into the woodwork for months. Fintan tells the story of how he went into Vincent and McGill with an idea for a story, and Vincent handed him, what was it, an extraordinarily large amount of money. He said, go away and come back with the story. And he went away for 2 months. He was a freelance, came back with the story. And it was 100%. But in big organisations, risk management takes various forms. And I think every journalist I know would be apprehensive that the reaction to this would take the form of an over-reliance on risk management. And I think the answer to that is not more and more committees, but cultural development and skill development at every level of the organisation, so that everybody at every level asks the questions that they know are important and don't pass that job out to a committee who may know little or nothing about the interests involved.
So how do you see investigative journalism moving forward now?
Somebody once said that news is what somebody somewhere doesn't want published, all the rest is advertising. there are two main things I think that have to be considered. First of all, that society itself is becoming far more complex, so that the population as a whole is generally much less well informed about the interstices of policy making, policy execution, power and responsibility at all different levels. So there would be plenty of territory to explore there all the time for investigative reporting. And I would hope that people will learn the lessons from the bad experience that they've had in the past, and that this will help them in the future.
I see RT has undertaken to retrain 600 staff in line with your guidelines by the end of May. I mean, to what extent is there a danger that that may be just ticking the boxes rather than achieving any genuine understanding of what actually went wrong here?
Anything is better than nothing. A couple of hours of familiarisation with the guidelines is better than nothing, but it's not the answer to the problem. You're talking about the culture of a station here, and I think culture comes from the very top, right down to the bottom. If it doesn't start at the top and it doesn't permeate the organisation from the top, no amount of training at the bottom will help it to take root. So I think a combination of the two things is important. There needs to be training. You need to identify the key people and give them the training that's necessary. But you also need to make sure that from the very top down, that cultural shift, that challenge, that intelligent risk-taking is maximised.
And do you think lessons have been or will be learned here?
Oh, I'm sure they've been learned. Yes, I'm positive they have been learned. There's a danger that there will be a dip, a chilling effect, but I hope it won't last for too long.
Talk about this suggestion of a conference on investigative journalism across all media, broadcast
yes.
and print and online.
I've changed my view a little bit on that. One of my suggestions was that RTE might have a conference or a seminar on the values and challenges of investigative journalism. But because they've been so much in the wars over this themselves, over the Father Reynolds case, I think it would be more appropriate if something like that was co-managed by organisations like the Press Council and the BAI, so that the issues can be addressed in a less frenetic atmosphere than they might be addressed if they were directly the responsibility of RTE. It's very difficult to establish guidelines that are good for all times and all circumstances. Every situation is different. Every ethical, professional issue and decision has to be made in a slightly different set of circumstances. So I think some broad teasing out of the boundaries and of the possibilities of investigative reporting when things have calmed down a bit might be good for all media organisations, because I really think that even though there are technology-related issues, the basic core values of journalism, whether it's investigative journalism or get the Reverend Mother's name spelt properly, you know, that these are not platform specific, that they reach right across the field from print into the audiovisual media and indeed onto the net.
We talk about regulatory unity.
Yes.
You know, when you have print, broadcast, all generally ending up online, do we not need one overall regulatory authority?
There is, at least in theory, the possibility of a regulatory or a professional practice body for journalism and news-related media, because that is where issues of bias and balance and impartiality do come to the fore, much more so than in other areas where there's a bigger entertainment quotient and these issues aren't quite so important. In theory, there's no reason why they shouldn't be. In practice, there are lots of obstacles that would have to be overcome. Even if we can't achieve some kind of common basis for content regulation, at least begin to share the values and the principles that we think are important right across the field.
Just to come back to the Reynolds case, one of the points that's been made again and again about this particular situation was that Father Reynolds was in the rare position, lucky in one way, of being able to actually scientifically disprove the allegations that were made against him. I mean, you've suggested in your report sort of random auditing, almost peer review, stress testing of packages that have gone out in the past to see whether the same sort of attitudes existed unchallenged and maybe slipped under the radar in previous cases. Do you think that's going to happen?
Like all these things, it costs money. I think it should happen on a fairly rare and occasional basis. Last 20-odd years of my professional life, I worked in a university. And for the latter part of that period, we had external peer review of our university departments. We had never in 20 years been reviewed, challenged or tested by anybody. It was extraordinarily valuable and sometimes very painful. And I see no reason why broadcasting organisations shouldn't occasionally take a leaf out of that book.
OK, John, thanks very much for that.